saying that this, thank you for this very interesting paper is the same to say your paper really sucks. So just be careful.
Thank you.
I said in some parts of the world.
This not being such a loss.
No, not at all. Seems like the scene is set, so no further ado, Mike.
My name is Mike Gutierrez, and I'm in the U.S., so that's obvious. I'm excited to be here. I was here in January for one of the seminars, and it was excellent, and there are so many more people here, so this is good. I'll get right to it. Thank you so much, Eric, for that survey. Takes a lot of weight off of my shoulders. Nevertheless, I will mention a few things about where I'm coming from, and then we can decide where I'm going. So when I talk about a sound object, I don't want to talk about the physical vibrations, the air moving as if that had. I'm sure it has relevance, and it'll have relevance near the end, but at first, when we're doing a phenomenology, we're not speaking in such objective terms. It becomes sound once it's heard and attended to in perception. So standard phenomenology would say, Husserlian would say that the imaginary versus the real makes no difference at first when we're doing phenomenology. This also means, for me at least, that human, animal, and technological subjectivities could equally occur. Basic. Also, I want to talk, when I talk about acoustics, I want to talk as generally as I can, not merely in a material sense or in a reverberative sense, unless we're talking reverberation as a metaphor, but the way that we organize sounds, and that they can be, that the organization itself can be, that'll become clearer later. So what I am going to try to do here, and please tell me if I succeed, is to start with a phenomenology of listening and go toward a sociology of how we organize what I'm going to call the acoustic orders. And so, of course, then there's the reverse, that the acoustic orders influence our perception and our phenomenological habits and things like that. So there's a circuit happening. I have to make that clear. So, again, this is a bit of review, but this is good. So we're not trying to discover, or at least I'm not trying to discover, the sound's essence. The problem here, of course, historically with Husserl and Heidegger, is that phenomenology had somewhat adopted the philosophical habit of looking for essences and trying to reduce one's assumptions in order to let the object speak for itself. I'm not trying to do that. So in that sense, I'm not a classical phenomenologist. I am trying to look at the process of audition and how that can change the very objectivity of the sound itself. In my dissertation, I'm talking a bit about technology and the way that there's a technique of listening, and that the technique is what creates the sound object. So, I have three general categories. Here we get into, I should say first, I'm trying to start over with phenomenology. We saw a few options, and Pierre Schaeffer is another that has been very influential. I'm not coming from a musical, in this work, I'm not starting from a musical assumption, and I'm not trying to necessarily go toward a musical end. So I wanted to see if I could develop the most general and potentially universal phenomenology that I could of how sounds are presented to us, or maybe just me. So the first category or mode, this is a debatable word, category or mode, is the affective. And this is when sounds present themselves in this immediate embodied reaction. Arguably, sound always presents itself to us in this way. But the basic idea with the affective is that it is opposed to the symbolic or the representative, representational. So maybe we can't talk about the affective as anything but the supposed sort of the aura in Benjamin's sense of the sound before we think about it, before we make it meaningful, as it's just an embodied experience. It's almost hypothetical in that sense. So if we move on to the symbolic mode of listening, we have this abstraction, representation. As I said, sound takes on meaning here because of various associations we make, either to other sounds or aesthetic systems or referential things like signals, all of that. I'm kind of running through this quickly, but I'd love more time for questions. So, my third category is what I want to talk about most here, because I think it provides the foundation and motivation for actually changing acoustic orders. That's the line. Okay. Phenomenological excess. So I'm arguing that the two first modes of listening, or categories of listening in the sense that they can be stable, even momentarily. Surely no audition is stable for any length of time, certainly, but the fact is we can take a sound and interpret it and have some kind of stability or certainty or even comfort in what we have interpreted. With excess, that simply isn't the case. So that's the opposition happening between the first two and this third. One way that I'm trying to think of this is in terms of volume. Volume in two senses, capacity and intensity. In my dissertation, I talk about this metaphor of metabolism and digestion as a way of reconceiving the listening subject. And if you think about eating a meal and having a certain capacity that you require, and also a limit at which it's too much, within that range, you have a stable meal. In a similar way, with this concept of volume in phenomenological intention, you have an intended range of listening. In Ivy's terms, you have a certain field of listening within a more general horizon, or you have a vocal listening. As long as sounds in various qualities remain within that, you can have this stable perception. If they go outside of that, whether it's in loudness or timbre or attack or decay or clarity, we wouldn't want to say fidelity, but it becomes excessive. All of this is a rather basic argument, but I do think it changes our mindset. So by extending beyond these perceptual intentions, sounds are unprepared, surprising, uninterpretable, or ineffable. It's simply that they cannot be contained within our intention. So, noise, favorite topic of many, would be, of course, too much. That the sound exceeds the intentions of the listener. Now, when I say intention, for those unaccustomed to talking in phenomenological terms, it's not willfulness necessarily. It's not necessarily conscious willing. It's the this is why I like this volume. It's more of a capacity or a directedness or a disposition toward the perception. Silence is the reverse. And of course these happen in degrees, but silence is when the intentions of the listener exceed the sound received. environment takes is this third form of excess, and it's more temporal. So rather than thinking in terms of simply being too much or too little, we're now thinking in terms of a field where multiple sounds exist, and we displace sounds at various times in order to focus on one and then another, even though we are aware that there's more than we are currently within. Again, I've tried to make the most basic terminology here so that it can be the most general. So, argument happens here with acoustic orders. So, switching tracks now from phenomenology to the social organization of sound, even the material organization. So we could talk about sonic order, but then we might merely be going toward this physical explanation. We could talk about aural order, but then we'd perhaps just be talking about psychological or just phenomenological interpretation. Of course, many of us approach sound as more than just the thing that's happening in someone's experience, but also things that are happening in the world. So in bridging that, I think acoustics can be a general term that talks about these, as I'm saying, spatial configurations of sonic and aural practice. And paired with the term order, you can start to see a logic that could go both in the phenomenological realm and also in this spatial social realm. Okay. Part of this is going to depend on some political social theory of Henri Lefebvre, who talks about three spatial modes. I'm actually probably going to skip this unless someone wants to go into it in the questions. but I will touch on Desarteaux. And to say that configurations of sound can have dominating or even hegemonic forms in society. So there are ways that sounds have been organized, whether we talk about musical aesthetics or we talk about noise regulations, whatever field we want to, that there is a dominant way of doing things, of making sounds and interpreting sounds. On the practice of everyday life level, we can also talk about the strategies, of especially of individuals or communities, to usurp or challenge such dominant modes. That might be a side thing here. Here's what it's coming down to. If excess is this risk and unpredictability, uninterpretability, within the phenomenological realm, and if that creates some kind of instability for the subject itself, then we generally want to minimize this phenomenon. We don't want to have unintegrated selves or unintegrated perceptions. We want to make sense of things. One way to do that is by organizing the social world in such a way that we have less excessive sense. So this is kind of as basic as the argument gets. We can change both the acoustic order of our perception, the intentions that we have towards sound. We can also change sound in the world. Material, sonically, perceptually, and habitually. So, again, I was trying to find the motivation for why we change both our mindsets and the way the world sounds. This is one potential path of finding that. Of course, it's as complex as it seems, it's also rather simple or even common sense. But for this very complex history of phenomenology, I think it boils things down at least to where I want to go. So I would love to stop there and see where you'd like to take it.
Thank you. This is great. Now we have lots.
of time, even more than Q&A, we can even have a discussion.
Please.
Wonderful. So we can still cut the crap, we don't have to be polite, just go to it. And my impression is that it's some kind of the acousticological that Mike really wants to discuss. But feel free, anyone. Yes.
I'm kind of puzzled by your final statement, the idea of minimizing excess. I can imagine that in everyday life you would like to have some kind of integrated subjectivity as a person in everyday life, so you can act in a in a functional and so-called normal manner. But I can imagine in other situations, which we might call aesthetic or artistic situation, that you would like to chase after this excess and really experience the unexpected and the disintegration or whatever.
Yeah.
Isn't that a very important element of our pleasure in the widest sense of the word when we experience art or music or sound in general? Or am I missing something?
No, you're certainly not. Yesterday there was a transmission seminar in Copenhagen, and I didn't quite give all this, but one thing I did question was, what is the role of sound art? That was the theme of it. And does sound art necessarily go toward excess? Does it have a responsibility to be excessive? Or maybe the reverse of responsibility, to be generating the beauty or a better, a healthier way to listen.
Elevating music.
Not normally. So I think that in the art sense, we might go toward them. However, in the phenomenological sense, that would be a contradiction according to a more fully developed notion of excess that I'm using here, because, for instance, noise music it would be something that we would, if we listen to it as music, and if we enjoy even the process of being stretched or broken, we have made that aesthetic. We have made that symbolic or affective for ourselves. It's those sounds that, and those moments of sounding that cannot be contained in such pleasurable experiences. That it's the interruption, the door slamming. It could be anything, but that's what is excessive. Not these more intentional artistic events.
So would you then say that this idea of has been made harmless because it is contained within a specific aesthetic situation, for instance, it is called noise music, so we know what to expect, so unexpected isn't really
it's no
unexpected
longer
anyway.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Yeah.
So we have a great capacity to exchange respond to sounds of the world, and that's what I'm arguing that we do. We either change our perceptual mode, or we change the way the world sounds if we no longer want to hear those things. For instance, we have living rooms, and sometimes we want the living rooms to be as quiet as possible. So we close windows, we close doors, we put earphones in anything to make it the way we want it to sound when we no longer can adjust our own intentional state.
Yes?
Question on terminology. When you presented the three terms, sonic or acoustic, you said something, at least I heard you that way, that the acoustic sort of integrates the sonic and the oral.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then towards, then my question becomes, what is the role of intention in acoustics? When you, towards the end, say that you can change both your intentional states and your acoustic situation, isn't the intention already part of your acoustic situation, in a sense?
It is. Intention and then agency is kind of what I'm trying to bridge. In political theory, I think that Lefebvre and Desarteaux do a sort of phenomenology of social political life. And so intentionality is not a word that they use, but I think it's analogical to what's happening here, which is part of the reason I think it can work. Maybe it can't, but I'm trying. So intention there, like you said, the phenomenological intention of the aural that I'm speaking of would have to be translated in this theoretical sense to more material intentionality or action of agency.
Yeah, okay.
I think that they work together,
mm-hmm.
but it's not quick.
Right.
Yes, I'm puzzled with the idea of stable perception you mentioned at the end.
Yeah.
Because at the same time you mentioned before, and I think it was interesting, that sound can be compared to kind of metabolism.
Yeah.
What we have observed is that one specificity of sound comparing to other senses is precisely that it is a metabolic perception, never the same, it changes all the time. The ground and the figure always go up and down, the foreground and background. So how would you define or elaborate on the stable perception?
Yeah, so this is perfect. Stability here is not static in any sense, but it's the stable process. So just as we're digesting the cake, hopefully all in stable manners right now, and yet the cake is changing, in the same way, us being able to receive sounds and interpret them and categorize them and memorize them and respond to them in a process, that's what I'm looking at as either stable or unstable. And so in contrast to the excessive, where that process breaks down. Excessive sound, if we have more time, we could go into all kinds of examples, but it's difficult to pin down because we so quickly adjust to it. In a similar sense that the body might adjust to poison in various ways. We desire this homeostasis, right? And yet homeostasis isn't death. It's a stable process. So that's the analogy that I think works.
I wanted to ask you a question about the relation between excess and order. Because your argument for order, so to speak, seem to be to avoid perversion, either physically as a kind of masochism towards the too muchness of sound, or as an avoidance of schizophrenic sound.
Yeah.
So in a way, a very healthy project. But this schizophrenia challenges your framework, and it comes out of, in one way, the same tradition, but takes the tradition in a more perverse way. Would you be able to sort of minimize that schizophrenia, or would it simply be something that you sort of have to bypass and repress to get the order to function?
Now it's fun, right? I'm not going to answer that.
To return of the repressed.
Yes. Because I like my own schizophrenia here in the project to talk about excess in this way that we can't capture it, and to talk about order as if we could, right? And so a lot of discussions on the various ways that society is ordered or aesthetics are ordered, we often speak as if it makes sense. And we really think we've landed on something. And here, one of the challenges I'm making, rather subtly, because in the American context, I can't go towards such excesses. one of the things I'm trying to say is that we can't, in a phenomenology, be so precise. I was going to ask a question earlier, but of course, we're at the time here. Husserl was so focused on finding that logical grounding of the self, perhaps in the auto-affection, and this is Derrida's critique of him then, that no such thing can be achieved. If excess is at the root of our motivation for change, then if that change is going toward an ideal of order, it seems like an inherently unstable foundation, and it seems like the ideal of order will never be achieved. And so, I'm not sure. Then maybe this is challenging to the musicologist, but I don't know. I'd love to hear if it is, because it seems like musicology is often trying to find some type of order, some type of way to universalize a description. or even just a system. Of course, I'm trying for the same thing, but that would be the tension that I'm trying to keep rather than resolve.
We actually have time for one more question, if that's possible.
Yeah, well, I'd like to back up a bit, because I think you got off a bit too easy with the difference between effectivism and embodied meaning.
Okay.
You put it in hierarchical order, effective it comes first and then symbolic comes afterwards and it's referential.
I
tried to find any case where that actually applies to actual listening situations, because usually the referential meaning is influencing the way you hear the sound as a prime aspect of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So the symbolic is embedded into the ground for the affective. So how did you manage to make that kind of easy decision?
Arbitrarily.
I'd like to do it myself, but I can't.
Right. Well, and this is what I've been finding in trying to write it,
yeah.
Is how would I write the affective?
Mm.
How would I even talk about it except as whatever happens prior to the symbolic?
Mm.
And I keep in my head, and I try not to write it because it doesn't sound very professional for this context, but of... like ignorance from childhood, and maybe that applies when we're uninitiated to certain either sort of sounds or types of sounds or context for sounding. Maybe that happens, but it so quickly goes toward the symbolic, if it happens at all. And then, as we're adults, we are always predicting. Like much of life and minimizing risk is about being able to predict what happens next, and so we change our intentions to widen them so that we're not surprised, so that we're not disturbed, so that we're stable. And that means that it's very hard now to get these affective situations, because we already know that, I mean, I could go over and put a CD in and play any configuration of sound that's possible on a CD, and you would probably be fine with it. Because by this point we've heard almost every sound.
Yeah.
No.
If you go back, I mean, if you take a newborn child,
yeah.
I make experiments with my children when they're newborn, you know, and they seem to immediately recognize my voice because I've spoken to them before they were born.
Yeah.
So they already have a reference, but as soon as they get out.
So do you think I should get rid of the affective?
No, I think it's I can't make the hierarchic system work in that way.
Okay. And
they're both embedded into each other,
mm-hmm.
So you have to make the relationship more complex.
I agree.
Yeah.
I'll take that. And that's why the work continues, right?
Sure. Thank you all. And then we have change the scenery again. For those who want